This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Morning Run. It is 7:35, Tuesday, the 22nd of March. And of course, you're listening to Tan Chen Lee, Philip C from an undisclosed location. And I'm Wong Shao Ning. In the meantime, we are turning our attention to Myanmar because the Biden administration has formally declared that Myanmar's years-long repression of the Rohingya Muslim population as genocide. This designation has been long anticipated by many, especially human rights groups and lawmakers, and advocates think that this would bolster efforts to hold the junta accountable.
Described by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres as one of the most discriminated people in the world, the Rohingya are one of Myanmar's many ethnic minorities who have been denied citizenship by the government of Myanmar and excluded from the 2014 census that refused to recognize them as people of Myanmar. And at least 700,000 of the Rohingya have since fled into neighbouring Bangladesh after the military launched a crackdown on this minority in 2014. But does this designation of a genocide help with the crisis faced by the Rohingya people?
For more insights, we turn to Hunter Marsden, researcher at the Australian National University. Good morning, Hunter. Now, the Biden administration, they intend to declare Myanmar's years-long repression of Rohingya Muslim population as genocide. Help us understand, what does this formal declaration really do?
Well, the decision is essentially political rather than legal, although it does follow a long and extensive review of facts and statistics compiled from Myanmar and the last decade of repression against the Rohingya. But essentially, it's political, and the move will build support for international sanctions as well as the ongoing criminal law, a legal case against the Myanmar military at The Hague.
This designation has been long anticipated by human rights groups and also lawmakers. Why has the Biden administration took so long to make the declaration?
Well, the report actually follows the Biden administration coming to office, initiating its own review of events in Myanmar and the military's crimes of 2016 and 17. Now, the Trump administration previously had launched its own investigation into this, and its review was ultimately inconclusive. There was a great debate inside of the Trump administration over whether to announce that the crimes against humanity amounted to genocide or not. Ultimately, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo determined that it was ethnic cleansing, and the Trump administration shied away from using the genocide label. So when Biden came to office, he announced the formation of a new review, reportedly thousands of pages of documents and testimonies from Rohingya survivors in Bangladesh and around the world have been considered. So it's a lengthy process, and I think the important thing is that, you know, it wanted to get the facts straight. But of course, the political circumstances do dictate some of the timing here. And following the coup of last year, about 13 months ago, I think the Biden administration finally felt that it had the necessary political circumstances to say, this is the fault of the military. We're not necessarily blaming the civilian government. There is no longer a civilian government that really holds the reins in Naypyidaw. So the timing was right.
Hunter, this is the eighth time since the Holocaust that the U.S. has actually concluded a genocide has occurred. But more interestingly, do you think this then puts pressure on other countries to also take this position that there is a genocide?
Sure. I think it definitely opens the door for other countries to use this language. Already, as you know, many human rights activists and organizations around the world have been referring to this as a genocide. So I think there's a popular consensus in global media that the military's crimes were genocidal, or at least amounted to crimes against humanity. But Washington's declaration of genocide here, I think, does make pretty clear that Western governments, at least, can refer to it as such. And really, it sort of piggybacks on the momentum of the international legal case that the Gambia filed against Myanmar and the Myanmar military, particularly in the International Court of Justice.
The Myanmar military-led government has already been slapped on multiple sanctions by the U.S. Does this declaration mean to bring on additional new measures against the Myanmar government?
I think so. It's hard to tell, but Washington essentially has ratcheted up sanctions gradually. One remaining area that remains unsanctioned so far that many activists have called for to be added to the list of targets is Myanmar's oil and gas enterprise, a state-owned company which is now under the control of the military and has millions of hundreds of millions in revenue every year, which is a sort of standout area where the Biden administration could still squeeze the military a little bit more on the sanctions side of things.
And let's talk about solutions. Do you think the ASEAN response is the right way forward? And do you think it has responded with sufficient efforts in terms of what they could do better to help resolve this, actually what is clearly a humanitarian crisis as well?
Well, I think the ASEAN process has frustrated many observers. The ASEAN five-point consensus announced in April of last year, which calls for a cessation of violence and political dialogue between all parties involved in this conflict, I think still holds as sort of a fundamental document and a roadmap for potential political solution. Thus far, however, ASEAN countries and ASEAN chairs have been unable to really press the junta to follow through with the roadmap laid out by the five-point consensus. That said, great powers like China and the United States have placed their support in the ASEAN five-point consensus and the ASEAN way for solving this process. And at this moment, ASEAN Special Envoy from Cambodia, as well as Secretary General, are both on there, or actually have arrived in Myanmar. So we'll see actually in probably the next few hours and coming days whether the ASEAN representatives are able to secure better access to the National Unity Government, civilian leaders, and representatives of the National League for Democracy, which the junta displaced.
Okay, so Hunter, I just want to get some clarification here because there are two issues running in parallel, right? One is, of course, the fact that there has been a coup in Myanmar and there's questions over the military dictatorship. And then side by side of that is the Rohingya crisis. Now, does these two issues complicate a solution to the Rohingya issue and the focus then becomes on the coup instead?
That's a really good question. That could be the case. However, I think the goal is, or at least the thinking in Washington, is probably to further isolate the military. This really sort of sets the tone for the international discussion and places the spotlight on them in having to defend themselves. The National Unity Government, or civilian leaders of Myanmar, have taken a distinct position to say we welcome international the case against the military, and they're willing to represent the country in the International Court of Justice against these charges, and has spoken very openly about the case of the Rohingya and military's violence. But to your question, I think that Washington is hoping to pile on the blame on the military. There's no longer a civilian government to sort of take the blame for them. And in this case, since the coup has come about, the military now stands to take the blame alone.
All right. Thank you for your time. That was Hunter Marsden, researcher at the Australian National University, with his views on what is really a complicated situation in Myanmar, because there's two things going on. One is that military coup, and the second thing, of course, is the Rohingya crisis, which has been going on since 2014. But Philip, what were your thoughts?
Well, I think the US call is very symbolic, and hopefully it triggers other countries to do so. You even saw over, I think, night where they saw India and Japan, I think both collectively tried to put pressure on Myanmar, although they didn't go as far as calling it sanctions. But if you talk about economic sanctions, you know, Hunter made a very interesting point that it is oil and gas which is a core element of Myanmar's economy. But if you look at who are the core trading partners for Myanmar, China, right? China accounts for 1/3 of trade with Myanmar. And so that's the key partner. And then second, followed very closely behind, is ASEAN. So really, if you really want to impose proper sanctions that reflect the economic and political situation in Myanmar, you really have to get in touch with these two key trading partners.
Yeah, it's challenging because sanctions have been slapped on military dictatorships for years. And do they really truly work? Yeah. We're talking about a country that until Myanmar, for a brief period, there was a form of democracy with Aung San Suu Kyi. Then they're back in power again. They are almost immune to sanctions. It's not something new to them. And whether the ASEAN approach really works is a question mark. Let's see in terms of what headway the envoy can currently make. We'll be following this story very closely. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.